Farewell address of the President in the President's office, January 15th, 1953.
My fellow Americans, I'm happy to have this opportunity to talk to you once more before I leave the White House. Next Tuesday, General Eisenhower will be inaugurated as President of the United States. A short time after the new president takes his oath of office, I will be on the train going back home to Independence, Missouri. I will once again be a plain private citizen of this great republic. That is as it should be. Inauguration Day will be a great demonstration of our democratic process. I'm glad to be a part of it, glad to wish General Eisenhower all possible success as he begins his term. Glad the whole world will have a chance to see how simply and how peacefully our American system transfers this vast power of the presidency from my hands to his. It is a good object lesson in democracy. I'm very proud of it, and I know you are too. During the last 2 months, I've done my best to make this transfer an orderly one. I've talked with my successor on the affairs of the country, both foreign and domestic, and my cabinet officers have talked with their successors. I want to say that General Eisenhower and his associates have cooperated fully in this effort. Such an orderly transfer from one party to another has never taken place before in our history. I think a real precedent has been set. In speaking to you tonight, I have no new revelations to make, no political statements, no policy announcements. There are simply a few things in my heart that I want to say to you. I want to say goodbye and thanks for your help. And I want to talk to you a little while about what has happened since I became your president. I'm speaking to you from the room where I have worked since April 12, 1945. This is the president's office in the West Wing of the White House. This is the desk where I have signed most of the papers that embodied the decisions I have made as president. It has been the desk of many presidents, and it will be the desk of many more. Since I became president, I've been to Europe, Mexico, Canada, Brazil, Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, Wake Island and Hawaii. I've visited almost every state in the Union. I've traveled 135,000 miles by air, 77,000 by rail, and 17,000 by ship. But the mail always followed me, and wherever I happened to be, that's where the office of the president was. The greatest part of the president's job is to make decisions, big ones and small ones, dozens of them almost every day. The papers may circulate around the government for a while, but they finally reach this desk. And then there's no place else for them to go. The president, whoever he is, has to decide. He can't pass the buck to anybody. No one else can do the deciding for him. That is his job. That's what I've been doing here in this room for almost 8 years. And over in the main part of the White House, there's a study on the second floor. A room much like this one, where I've worked at night and early in the morning on the papers I couldn't get to at the office. Of course, for more than 3 years, Mrs. Truman and I were not living in the White House. We were across the street at the Blair House. That was when the White House almost fell down on us and had to be rebuilt. I had a study over at the Blair House, too, but living in the Blair House was not as convenient as living in the White House. The Secret Service wouldn't let me walk across the street, so I had to get in a car every morning to cross the street to the White House office, again at noon to go to the Blair House for lunch, and again to go back to the office after lunch, and finally take an automobile at night to return to the Blair House. Fantastic, isn't it? But necessary, so my guards thought, and they are the bosses on such matters as that. Now, of course, we're back in the White House. It is in very good condition, and General Eisenhower will be able to take up his residence in the house and work right here. That'll be much more convenient for him, and I'm very glad the renovation job was all completed before his term began. Your new president is taking office in quite different circumstances than when I became president 8 years ago. On April 12, 1945, I've been presiding over the Senate in my capacity as vice president. When the Senate recessed about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I walked over to the office of the Speaker of the House, Mr. Rayburn, to discuss pending legislation. As soon as I arrived, I was told that Mr. Early, one of President Roosevelt's secretaries, wanted me to call. I reached Mr. Early, and he told me to come to the White House as quickly as possible, to enter by way of the Pennsylvania Avenue entrance, and to come to Mrs. Roosevelt's study. When I arrived, Mrs. Roosevelt told me the tragic news, and I felt the shock that all of you felt a little later when the word came over the radio and appeared in the newspapers. President Roosevelt had died. I offered to do anything I could for Mrs. Roosevelt, and then asked the Secretary of State to call the cabinet together. At 7:09 p.m., I was sworn in as president by Chief Justice Stone in the cabinet room. Things were happening fast in those days. The San Francisco Conference to organize the United Nations had been called for April 25th. I was asked if that meeting would go forward. I announced that it would. That was my first decision. After attending President Roosevelt's funeral, I went to the hall of the House of Representatives and told a joint session of the Congress that I would carry on President Roosevelt's policies. On May 7th, Germany surrendered. The announcement was made on May the 8th, my 61st birthday. Mr. Churchill called me shortly after that and wanted a meeting with me and Prime Minister Stalin of Russia. Later on, a meeting was agreed upon, and Churchill, Stalin, and I met at Potsdam in Germany. Meanwhile, the first atomic explosion took place out in the New Mexico desert. The war against Japan was still going on. I made the decision that the atomic bomb had to be used to end it. I made that decision in the conviction that it would save hundreds of thousands of lives, Japanese as well as Americans. Japan surrendered, and we were faced with the huge problems of bringing the troops home and reconverting the economy from war to peace. All these things happened within of just a little over 4 months, from April to August 1945. I tell you this to illustrate the tremendous scope of the work your president has to do. All these emergencies and all the developments to meet them have required the president to put in long hours, usually 17 hours a day, with no payment for overtime. I sign my name on an average of 600 times a day, see and talk to hundreds of people every month, shake hands with thousands every year, and still carry on the business of the largest going concern in the whole world. There is no job like it on the face of the earth. In the power which is concentrated here at this desk, and in the responsibility and difficulty of the decisions, I want all of you to realize how big a job and how hard a job it is, not for my sake, because I'm stepping out of it, but for the sake of my successor. He needs the understanding and help of every citizen. It is not enough for you to come out once every 4 years and vote for a candidate and then go back home and say, well, I've done my part, now let the new president do the worrying. He can't do the job alone. Regardless of your politics, whether you are Republican or Democrat, your fate is tied up with what is done here in this room. The president is president of the whole country. We must give him our support as citizens of the United States. He will have mine, and I want you to give him yours. I suppose that history will remember my term in office as the years when the Cold War began to overshadow our lives. I have had hardly a day in office that has not been dominated by this all-embracing struggle, this conflict between those who love freedom and those who would lead the world back into slavery and darkness.